They reviewed. Did you hear anything back?
Only one. Down under confidentiality, that was a spelling. Instead of participation, it said participate. So I did notice up above in the header, it said initially adopted. It should say 1/16/18 if you approve it today. It says 1/18/18. So that's a typo on my part. So that would be the only change I would need to make. And under reference BOS minutes, I would put in the date of the minutes that once are approved, I can't.
Yep.
Put that in there right now.
Good. So, if there are any questions, no questions, I take a motion to adopt with the corrections that Alyssa just.
I would move that we adopt the employee assistance program policy with the corrections noted by Ms. Rizzo.
Second.
Motion and second. Discussion. Olson.
Aye.
Chief.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye.
Thank you, Alyssa.
Thanks, Alyssa. Next, discussion consideration of ISAC's request to participate in statewide and nationwide opioid litigation. So this has been kind of an interesting process. About 4 or 5 months ago, we received something in the mail, and I took it. It looked like, and I don't know a better way to say this, but it looked like some kind of ambulance-chasing law firm trying to get us to sign on to a lawsuit. So I did what I do most of the time when I have a question. I went to see Deb Shildroth, and I said, Deb, what does this look like to you? And she said, yeah, that doesn't look right. So we filed 13. Separate from that, but similar, a request has come from ISAC that we join in a opioid lawsuit with a law firm that ISAC is working with on all of this. And so we talked about it as a board, referred it to legal counsel for some further assessment, and that's what's coming back to us today.
Yep. And I would mention, too, the ISAC board adopted a resolution and believes it's important for counties in Iowa to join counties from other states in this unified front in dealing with the opioid epidemic. So the purpose of this litigation would involve holding certain pharmaceutical companies responsible for damages to the public in misrepresenting the safety of using opioids. I'll get that word right here at one point in time. So the information was referred on to the county attorney's office, and Ethan Anderson and Jessica Reynolds worked on it together. They reached out to other county attorney offices. They also contacted the firm directly just to get some clarification that was involved some information sent in the materials that were sent to us. And their recommendation back was in a letter form that was provided to the board and part of the documentation on the website. And the recommendation is to decline from participating in this litigation effort based on the following concerns. There were two main ones. First, there's language provided in the sample resolution stating that the county has spent millions of dollars in unexpected and unbudgeted time and resources to address the opioid epidemic. Without an accurate figure on these costs, it's hard to maintain support for this litigation. So I had reached out at Ethan's request to some of our local providers on what they're dealing with in terms of this epidemic and the costs and the services provided. What we find as of right now is a large share of the individuals getting any kind of substance abuse treatment are on insurance. They're covered either in the private sector or more public Medicaid coverage. There are a couple of providers that do receive grants from the Department of Public Health to help offset costs related to substance abuse, but a lot of times it's a mixture of substances being used. It's not just prescription medications. So it was hard to quantify and put a dollar amount to that particular part of the equation. With our county funds that are run through the community services office to help with detox services, we're not seeing as much of those funds expended, again, because people have some kind of insurance coverage that's covering those particular services. So that was concerning to the county attorney's office when we can't really put a dollar figure on what it's costing Story County to pay for and provide that level of treatment. So there was some concern there. The second concern was the potential for fees to be assessed against the county. So in the event this litigation effort is unsuccessful and results in dismissal of all claims, who's going to bear those expenses? It could be a substantial amount, and though counties would split fees equally, that was written in some of the resolution, this arrangement has not been formalized. So that brought concern to the county attorney's office in terms of what could this cost Story County and how far down the road. It would just be one of those, you know, unexpected, maybe unplanned kinds of items, and we're just not sure what that dollar amount would be. So the recommendation is not to participate in this, but if the county finds itself in needing to go in some kind of a litigation route with a pharmaceutical company or something related to this epidemic, they would be happy to sit down with the board and look at options and how to deal with that potential litigation. Questions or comments?
I was a little bit put off by the approach by ISAC when it was like 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. We had a regional meeting over in Boone one night, and this was a discussion topic and a presentation, and at the time, I think it was a single-digit number of counties that had taken up this as far as signing off on it. I don't know what it would be like. The number would be today, but I guess I didn't come away with a real clean feeling on it, and to see what was presented here by the county attorneys gives me pause in the fact that I don't know if it's something I feel comfortable in participating in.
I saw an article, I'm sure others did, in the Des Moines Register that ISAC is reporting that there are now 34 counties that have signed up. I did go to the Story County Opioid Task Force last month and let them know that we were looking at this. Possibly some before. But anyway, I said, what do you guys think about it? Okay. In theory, it's a great idea. The task force is made up of police officers from both Ames Police Department. We have an officer from the task force, Central Iowa, on it. There's also law enforcement and treatment people from ISU. There are several different providers that work with addictions and opioids. And theoretically, it's a really great idea to go. They have lived with the pressure, all the marketing over the years of the drug, of the big pharma, as they call them, okay? But when I started to read out kind of what we had received from ISAC, and once again, they were concerned about being able to even report a number about how much is being spent, the task force is still struggling with trying to split out numbers about who's actually overdosing from opioids here in the county. Most people aren't using them separately from other drugs, unless they might be an older population or isolated, okay? So the overdoses they're seeing are a variety of the opioids, plus there might be alcohol in the system, etc. So they don't even know how to figure out how to split that out. Mary Greeley's dealing with some strict HIPAA regulations. So supporting this from a practical basis would be very difficult. Their heart is with this. This would be great. I do believe that if we went back and bring up the second point about that, actually there could be a real cost to the county later on, which was not laid out in the materials that we saw at all, that I do not believe some of the opioid task force members would be so excited about it. They'd rather see whatever dollars we're spending to go in to help. Maybe there are some gaps in just the, some people who are released from prison and don't have coverage for a while, et cetera. I want to enter into the record a letter that I was asked for that for the record. We're not going to read it. It's quite long. But it is from Natasha Daniel. And Natasha lost her daughter to Sarah Burnside to a synthetic opioid overdose. in December of 2016. And so she has written, she obviously, the theme here is we need to do everything we can. And so I guess I would say that she goes on the record is asking us, please do what we can do. It does not speak out about the lawsuit itself one way or the other.
Okay, so we got three choices. We can vote to enter and participate in the litigation. We can vote to not participate, or we can take no action, which in effect means we will not participate at this time. You guys' choice.
There's not. I guess Ethan and through the attorney's office makes enough of a reasoned argument in my mind that taking this cause up at this time does not have any service to the county, and I would never put ourselves in a position where there was a financial downside by joining in something, and that clearly was stated. So I'm either two or three, and I don't care which.
Yeah, and I'm right there too. I'm two or three. This is not something we have to take action on. Taking no action, we aren't in.
I agree. I have no inclination to make a motion one way or the other. The last thing I will note is that this week, the task force met again after the opioid open hall, town hall that was had last week. And it was
how well attended was that?
100 people, 100 plus. The room, according to Ames City Hall, because they opened up the judges' chambers also. And the room holds 115 people, so every chair was filled. There were people standing. It is a topic of interest, and it was just not, as I looked around, what I would call the people who would usually show up, who are the treatment people themselves. I mean, there were plenty of treatment people there, but there were people who had come down from Webster City. There were people who had come who had family members who, the takeaway that the task force realizes there's much more follow-up work need to be done in trying to decide how do you reach people. I'm going to be making some phone calls based upon a recommendation from the dais that we need to get some more providers who can actually work to prescribe the medications that help people get off. There is a cap on physicians. They have to take a special accreditation, and then there's a cap on how many patients they can have at any one point in time. To administer, I'm going to say it wrong, Suboxone. It's basically a difference than methadone, but the whole medication treatment option. And we don't have enough providers in the county.
We got one in the county, and then we've got one more in the region, but the other one in the region is out on maternity leave right now. So she can't. She's
correct.
Not prescribing.
Right.
I was the third party of a conversation between Representative Lisa Heddens and Congressman Steve King's local representative a few nights ago, and I know that Representative Heddens brought it up as a very real concern. I know that Victoria, Congressman King's representative, was busy taking notes, and my experience with Victoria is she is really, really good about sharing those kind of things. And frankly, that strikes me as an issue. It will not surprise me at all if that is right in Congressman King's wheelhouse, because it's just common sense that if you've got multiple doctors that can prescribe opioids and you've only got two and one of them's out that can prescribe something that seems to battle it, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. So that's just a brief update.
All right. So I'm hearing no action from us, which in effect means we will not participate in this opioid litigation, but no action. Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb. Good job. Next is consideration for the direction of the Animal Control Director to have special promotions in reduced or no charge for adoption of animals as needed. So this came up during our budget work session with our Animal Control Officer. Hi, Sue.
Hi. How are you?
And good. And part of the conversation we were having is for a lot of the year, especially when it came to cats, we were almost literally filled to the rafter with cats. And the board and Sue had a great conversation, but it was pointed out a couple times there that the entire goal for our animal control ought to be moving these animals on, preferably to really good, solid homes, as quickly as possible. And Sue made the comment that some other animal control operations around us sometimes have free or reduced, and she hated the thought that we're missing on good homes for some of these animals because they view our $30 adoption fee as too much. Is that fair for how we got here?
Yeah, I think so.
And the other thing that I need to say to you before we have this conversation is I want to underscore. So part of our conversation was that we need to really work at controlling our populations in that we care for and for how long we care for them. And I'm afraid that as you left that meeting, you took that to mean that this board in any way was advocating that we start euthanizing more and more animals more and more readily. And I didn't hear that. I'd have Loris and Marty speak to that. I didn't hear that at all coming from this board.
I think that was my interpretation of it.
And I just want to understand that
mortifies me.
Sure.
And, you know, and I guess if we could do something like this, we would still follow our same procedure as far as vetting people. They fill out an application, they pass whatever criteria they need to on the application, and then you know, we would have, when we get these huge amounts, we're inundated with cats, not really dogs usually, but cats, that we would be able to have some sort of, like I was thinking for February, if this passes today, we could have Feline Fabulous February, you know, or Fabulous Feline February or something. And, you know, and we could go through and like I said, vet people the same way, but, you know, maybe try the first time to do free and see where that takes us. And there's a lot of competition, as I told you that day, out there in the animal world, and that's why so many shelters have started doing this free. I was totally against it until it occurred to me that if we can continue our vetting process, if it makes people come in and adopt animals and we can move them through more quickly, then it's a good idea.
So I agree with that completely. I think that our animal control director ought to have the leeway from this board to be able to make a determination that if... And in my mind, it's kind of twofold. If, from a capacity point of view, we're having too many animals, then we need to do whatever we can to try to encourage good potential pet owners to come in and get them. And if that means taking it down to reduced or no charge, we should do that. The other one is occasionally you're going to have animals come through that, for whatever reason, are not quite as adoptable, right? And I think you ought to have the leeway that when one of those animals comes in, you make it as easy as possible for that animal to end up in a good home. And again, if that means that we reduce or eliminate any kind of adoption fee, so the numbers are this. Story County spends somewhere just under $500,000 a year on our entire animal control operation. Our total adoption fees are about $10,000?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, so the idea that we would worry about $10,000 in adoption fee when we're spending $500,000, doesn't make any sense to me. If you agree that our goal is to get those animals out of our shelter as fast as we can into a really, really good situation, then we ought to do everything we can.
Right.
Board thoughts?
Obviously, I shared some of the same during the budget workshop. For this to work optimally, I really hope that you and your staff will reach out to get some help from, like, our outreach department, from Leanne and Chrissy, okay, that we are able to use robust social media. I know people come to your page, but any cross-promotion that we can do to reach out to other animal lovers who may not have already liked your Facebook page, you know, flyers. Also, if we can work out a way to have a little more rapid turnaround on the approvals, because some people do. We never want anybody who came and got an animal on a whim on a Friday morning, okay? Said, let's go get a cat, and they want to come home 2 hours later. But I think that we want to make sure that we are, since we are competing, time is a part of it as you're doing the vetting process. And the other thing I'd like to see is that we have them have right here, we're discussing to have special promotions. I would like to give you, as Rick said, if, you know, the opportunity to ever, if there's a family that comes in, especially if they're bringing their kids week after week, and they say, we can't afford an animal, but everything else checks out. They've got a home, so they can bring that animal in there or whatever, and you give away lots of free food. I'd like to see you be able to waive that adoption fee in that particular instance. That's your discretion, because then an animal gets a good home, and we provide a little help for them because we're getting that food donated anyway. So that's where I'd like to take out the special promotions part of it. And just say, you may do it, you see it.
The public may not realize, or maybe they do, that, I mean, in this department and this programming, that we were looking to put roughly $300,000 into enhancing the facility, talking about putting an additional staff member into this program. I mean, this is something that we value. We're putting dollars towards. We're trying to improve it. Now we're just taking it back to the very basics, and we find ourselves, because we are the facility, and I think the perception is that this is the place that if you have a stray animal or you want to see an animal with the greatest likelihood of success, we take it to Story County. Well, we find ourselves upside down, because I don't know what your cat count is today, but I suspect it's high.
It's actually down. Right. And I'd like to add that this is the highest year we've ever seen since I've been there.
I think that speaks to the program. I guess nobody's really addressed it in that sense, but I think people are bringing these cats to us because they think that they value the cat and they want to see the best outcome they can have, and maybe they can't do it in their own home.
Mm-hmm. And as for the only thing the only two things, just so you're aware of, is when we check their vet records, since we're in the position we're in, we have to follow the code of Iowa and our own ordinance about the rabies shot. So, you know, when somebody's adopting, we like to know that their animals at home do have a rabies shot, because that's what we're supposed to be promoting. And the other thing is a lot of times we try to do a courtesy to the people who own the buildings that if these people rent, the landlords, by calling them. The landlords really appreciate it, because I would say half the time people who apply for animals can't have them where they live.
Right.
And so we want the landlord to know that we're working with them, so we're not putting an animal in an apartment or a house that it's not supposed to be in later on. And so a lot of times when we're waiting for the landlords to call back, that's where we get into problems. Some of them don't return our calls. And, you know, we have some really, really good ones. Sometimes you can reach, they just answer the phone. And then there's a couple organizations that just call whenever they feel like it, and we have to badger them like 3 or 4 times to get them to respond. So what we've done now to try to help with that is, if a person has a copy of their lease agreement that shows that they've either paid the pet deposit or that, you know, it's okay for them to have an animal, then we're honoring that to speed the process up.
Do you have a list also of some of the bigger rental companies as far as they're just yes or no? I mean, so you don't have to call on those, correct?
Yes. Okay. If there's nothing further, I take a motion.
I would move that we direct the animal control director, to exercise her discretion in offering reduced or no charge adoption for animals as needed.
I would second that.
Motion second. Olson.
Aye.
Chief.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Thanks, Sue.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we're to departmental reports, where we're going to take a 2-minute recess first. All right. We will get back into session, and we got Jerry Moore with his quarterly report that he was kind enough to hold from last week.
Good afternoon. Quarterly report from the fourth quarter last year, so it's October through December. First thing you see is development cases. We had 11 compared to 7 from 2016 and then 1 in 2015. The highest category of subdivisions was 7, followed by rezonings with 3. Underneath that, I want to thank my staff for helping with the information with this. Without them, this is not possible, and it won't look as pretty if I put this together. The lower box deals with the total numbers of development cases. We're looking at amendments and ordinances. I need to give credit to Leanne. She worked on a couple of these. They happen to be under the Story County Land Development Regulations, the solar, and the amendment process for C2C. CUPs, subdivisions, rezonings, appeals, annexations, variances. Total for the year, 52 compared to 42 from 2016 and 17 in 2015. So we're on the upward increase. This next one looks at zoning permits. Again, the fourth quarter, 33 compared to 28, so up 5. The dwellings is shown in blue. Everything else is orange, which is additions to dwellings, decks, pools, things of that nature. Valuation is up by about $14,000 from 2016. Again, just the fourth quarter. This is the map that I like. It shows you this is primarily the dwellings and the subdivision plats. A lot of activity around Ames, Nevada. But what's interesting is the single-family homes that were constructed south of Highway 30. So there's a lot of activity going on around Huxley, Cambridge, Maxwell, but it's also scattered throughout the county. Total numbers, 154 zoning permits compared to 152, so close, but up a couple from 2016, which compares to the 109 from 2015.
And I was interested that the average dwelling construction value went down $40,000.
Right. Ames Urban Fringe Plan, just an update there. The amendment that Kurt Friedrich was requesting at Cameron School Road, George Washington Carver, it got approved for the west side of George Washington Carver. The board approved the entire package, the portion that the city was requesting, which include the Irons, Borgmeyer, and the golf course, but that didn't get approved when it went to the city of Gilbert, so the planning staff at Ames is intending to go back to the city of Gilbert and ask them to take action to support for the portion that they are that they submitted. Jensen, you'll recall that you reviewed the residential parcel subdivisions for his properties on South Duff, Highway 69. The four parcels to split those once into two, that was approved with a condition that he get approval on the amendment for the land use designation, which he started, and then added two. There's two parcels to the north that he is interested in acquiring. He owns five additional lots north of that. He wanted that to all be included in this amendment, and it was before the city council on the 9th, and they did not take action to support taking a look at that. So that's going to put him, I think, in a position of just requesting the city of Gilbert and Ames to look at just that portion of, you know, that he brought forward with the subdivision plat. McKay property, 55240th Street. This is the property that YSS was interested in acquiring to doing the youth treatment facility. Property owner there did seek a request that was before the city council on the 9th. That he has another party interested in doing a commercial campground, an event center, and doing a bed and breakfast there. That also, there was no action by the city council on that one. But we're likely going to see an amendment request to our land development regulations with regard to commercial campgrounds that we look at language to allow permanent buildings. They caught on to what is happening with the county conservation ground and the interest in doing permanent facilities in those. So, again, the applicant submitted something for review, and we're going through that process to have that go before P&Z, and then that will be before the board. And as Kurt alluded to, we are working on a land use study. The plan is to have that before the P&Z no later than March.
Jerry,
yep.
When Kurt had said, well, I'd really like to persist this evening, you're not planning on forming, or are you thinking of forming a task force, or is this just...
It was not a part of our vision. You know, it's something that's on our work program. And so it's something that we were doing internally. We were going to work with the staff at Ames and Gilbert and then work with our Planning and Zoning Commission before coming to the Board of Supervisors with a recommendation. But, you know, we certainly, since he's expressed interest, we can reach out to him when we get to more of a final product. I mean, I certainly would take input from the board on how you would like our department to proceed with that.
I think our normal process seems to be pretty accessible already to people who are interested, because you've been worth to bring it to the planning and zoning. There's opportunity for comment there. And then there's opportunity when it comes to us, and there's opportunity here. If there were, I know you're addressing many ordinances this year, and I'm interested in hearing the feedback, but I hadn't envisioned in my head there being a task force on it kind of thing. And I got the feeling maybe that's what Kurt Friedrich was asking about.
Yeah.
Maybe I was wrong.
Well, I don't know that you're wrong. I think I would like to see, and I think we saw... I think we scratched the surface today of some frustration that is being felt in the development community right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not just specifically in dealing with Story County, but most definitely including dealing with Story County, some things seem to be more challenging than they have traditionally been. And I think it's in our best interest as a county that we get weigh in and potentially buy in from the entities that changes would impact. And in this case, to me, Lars, it means that letting the development community, and if that means the Scott Renauds of the world, or it means the Kurt Friedrichs of the world, broadly speaking, that we let them see and consider what changes are being proposed. We talked about intent today. We talked about unintended consequences today. That we let them dig in of how will this affect the way they go forward, and let them weigh in. And I would say earlier in the process, so I heard you just say, Jerry, that once it gets more, you know, some solidity to it, I'd like to see the development community weigh in sooner rather than later. Not necessarily that that's the way we're going to go, but I think it's in everybody's best interest if we understand the ramifications and maybe intended or maybe unintended consequences of some of the things that are going to come before us. We can either do that formally or informally. I mean, what I heard very clearly today is that when a potential change comes before us, I'm going to reach out to some people. And I'm saying individual now. I'm going to reach out to some people. We can either do that collectively, or we can each do it individually.
Right. Coming back to your concept, as you look at all of these ordinances, all right, are you looking at examining them all and interrelating them before it comes to us as a package, or are you considering them coming one at a time? Because I do hear what you're saying, Rick, and I also think that there are other people who want to weigh in besides the development community. There are other people who feel that there are impacts. Okay. So I'm looking forward to that process, and I had just laid out, I just said, I thought our process worked well. Well, it works well on an individual ordinance type basis. What I'm hearing from you is that there be that deeper, broader layout about, as a package, what are the impacts? As a package, what do our ordinances mean for the various stakeholders? I was going to find that.
that term weird, but I think it applies here. Okay. So, yeah, so I do hear what you're saying. And reaching out, whether it be informally or inviting, it could be more formally through workshops or task force or whatever. I'm open to anything. I'm more interested in what the staff thinks this might look like.
Yeah, well, we're working on stormwater, an amendment to the stormwater drainage section, and we just, you know, based on some of the issues that we've had with some of the developments, we took that upon ourselves. But with that process, we intend to include Scott, Kurt, developers, other engineers, other engineering firms that we work with that make submittals as a part of our review process. Also on our work program is, you know, we're supposed to look at the entire land development regulations. And internally we've done that, but I don't know that we envision a process where we would have a committee or go outside beyond, you know, internal discussion with other departments before going to P&Z and Board of Supervisors. But like on that specific stormwater, we definitely think we need to reach out.
Now, when you say that, reach out and involve them, so you're going to invite them to provide written comments? Are you going to invite
verbal,
them to
written,
a round table?
Verbal, and, written, whatever.
Okay. And then how do we reach out to the other stakeholders who might be interested?
Well, and we're also going to reach out to the environmental groups, Prairie Rivers staff. There's a couple of other organizations that I think we could provide great benefit with this work. But
okay. Well, and I want to make sure we're comprehensively reaching out, because there are a lot of people that are, like in the stormwater one, there are a lot of people who are interested, who've had a variety of experiences. So I think, you know, the reach out is great to make sure that we're reaching out. Formally and then informally, you're going to call your people. I'll probably call some of my people. I mean, you know, Marty has people who would want to weigh in on this too, who we know who provide us feedback on a more regular basis. Okay.
We could use our website too to post that we're going to be meeting and have it
large enough for the general public. I think more information out is preferable to less information out. And I think what's important for us to remember is there's three components in all this, right? There's what our ordinances say and how they interrelate. And we've got some places in our ordinances where there's very clear disagreement between two ordinances, right? And we've got some other places where it's not as clear as we'd like it to be. And there's areas that we need to continually work on clean up. But there's what the ordinance say. There's what was intended. What were we intending to do with this ordinance? Or what was the perception of what we were intending to do? And then finally is the application. How exactly do we, and this primarily falls with the Board of Supervisors based on recommendations for planning and zoning, but how do we actually implement what our ordinances and this perceived intent look like? And getting, you're never going to get everybody on the same page in any of this, but that to me is one of the reasons that you get as much buy-in as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
As you talk about
board action,
as you talk about getting to the point where we grow and develop as a county, because we're going to continue to grow and develop.
And I see the C2C as having done some of that.
So
now we're down to the actual, I suppose, the details,
right?
Okay. So I will look forward to what the staff brings forward as a process on this, because I want to make certain that we don't push the C2C to the side after all the work so many people have put into it. It's got sound principles. And I want to make sure that the feedback we're getting is based upon where we have true differences, where we're causing unintended consequences of significance to various stakeholders, as opposed to one person saying, getting down to the level where we're starting to disagree because someone doesn't like it because they may not be able to do something on one particular piece of land. I mean, you know, I think that it's very important. I think this could be a wonderful discussion for everybody to have this year to figure out where do our goals sit when it comes to when we plug them into the
C2C. Yeah, so I think you said it exactly right for us. The C2C is the look from 30,000 feet. And as we get to our ordinances and process and intent, we're getting closer and closer. But at the end of the day, ground level is exactly the conversation we had earlier today with Kirk Friedrich and Scott Renault. How does all of these things, so our philosophy combined with our rules and ordinances, combined with how we interpret those and how we implement them, affect the people on the ground who, in this case, got two development lots today, right? And figuring out how that goes.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to kind of shift
gears. Complaints, we have a few of them that we're working. Most of these sites we've been to at least once. Our view is that we try to work with people, get them to voluntarily comply with ordinance requirements. Some of these, however, are home business permit applications that come up through the renewal process. And I think some of these are maybe, you know, they can be addressed. They can meet our ordinance requirements. Some of them, they may have outlived the home business permit status, and they may need to look elsewhere to an area that's zoned for that use in the county or in a community. But I've talked to Leanne. I'm thinking about putting together an article to help, because there's quite a few of them, home business permit applicants, owners, property owners, with understanding what our requirements are. What we're running into is they're getting into a situation where they have a lot of outdoor storage and they're not supposed to have any outdoor storage, or they have a lot of, you know, more than one employee reporting to the site. So again, we try to work voluntarily with people before we get into the NLV or citation process. Just an update on Fernald. We did meet with them again on the 28th of November of last year. We had about 13 residents show up. Two planning and zoning commission members were there, two township trustees. Deb was there, Darren, Margaret, and then the planning staff. We were there to give them an update on the things that we've been working on, but also to talk to them about the income survey that we would like them to participate in. We identified some funding through grants that we might be able to obtain if they participated in the survey. Again, there was 13 there. Probably three quarters of them responded at the meeting. We sent out letters on the 19th, on the 5th, asked for return on the 19th of December, and we received 16 responses, or 33%. What we'd like to have was at least half of those, 50%, to respond to the interest of participating in the survey. And so, you know, because to do the survey, we need a 90% response rate.
If you already got six, you say they aren't willing.
Right. So, you know, I think our work with the Fernald project, again, this is a work program item, is kind of winding down. There's a few improvement issues that we're dealing with, compliance issues. But other than that, I welcome some input from the board on what you'd like us to do with this. Again, we're trying to help them with the flooding, the drainage problems that they have. There was some interest raised by some of the participants to maybe have the existing tile line televised to see if there's any obstructions. But Darren pointed out that there's a cost to doing that too. So again, we were trying to see if we could get a grant to help with the study and then possibly apply for a grant to do any project. But again, I think we're getting to a point where, other than the enforcement things, you know, I don't know what else our department should be doing with regard to this. So We are also to find some sites for construction demolition debris if we have a disaster. We did meet with a representative from the Iowa DNR finally, who was very, very helpful. Keith's department also met with us, gave us some really good information about testing soils right after the disaster happens, information about testing, after everything is completed, you know, what types of materials we can use to lay down. We were told by other sources that we have to do pavement for hazardous materials. That's not what we're hearing from this particular representative. Told us that we should apply for the burn permit through the DNR for the vegetation that we're going to get. That's an optimal way to deal with that material in lieu of mulching it. We've got a lease agreement that has been reviewed by the county attorney's office. They're looking at the ordinance. We're told that if we have a plan, a disaster management plan, that, you know, if we have a proclamation, we're more apt to, if we follow our plan, to get reimbursed, which is all what this is about. So we're working on that. We're trying to get some more information from third-party contractors to help us understand which ones have experience with disasters and cleanup, and which ones have been involved with FEMA before. This is something that we'd like to have done by March, or at least to the Planning and Zoning Commission, as far as the shoring up of those things. And then the work program, we met with the Planning and Zoning Commission. The board also met. We've got a few things there. We put them into tiers. Tier one is to be completed, or to the Planning and Zoning Commission, by the end of March. And many of these things will occur by then. We did get our census data in. Matt from the GIS coordinator is assisting with that process. And Leanne, our department, Matt, the 911 coordinator, auditor's office, will have an opportunity to review that data. We did add, under number 7, tier 2, there was a discussion of, you know, taking a look at the existing subdivisions, rural subdivisions, find out which ones are publicly dedicated, do an inventory of what kind of signage we have out there. So that's something that we put on there. We'll take that information to the P&Z before we come to the board. And then tier 3, you know, our goal is to have all these things accomplished by the end of this year. So I would like some support from the board. I can put this on the next week's consent agenda if the board's in agreement to everything that is on there.
Yeah, I like the work program. If you want us to take action on it, you'll need to put it on next week's agenda.
That's all that I have. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Yeah, questions for Jared?
None. We had a pretty good meeting with P&Z last month.
Yeah.
Yes, it's no surprise. Pretty robust, pretty aggressive. Appreciate it. Thanks what you did in Fort Pernal for the fact that I didn't think you were going to be able to tease a lot out, but it's a community that Darren's going to tell us here in a little bit. The railroad's not going to let us jet a tile, which is causing a lot of the hardships that we heard on several community meetings in the Pernal area, and that is clearly outside of our ability to get to that sweet spot, but that's for another presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Now we've got Darren Moon.
Come on down.
Steve Moon, thanks for spending your morning with us.
Yes, good afternoon.
Yeah, part of your afternoon.
Try to go fairly quickly through this. I know you got a budget meeting this afternoon. let me start on the maintenance work update. First of all, the late snow, and we had some warm weather as well into December, helped us really get a lot more work done, especially with bridge repairs. Show you some pictures of those. This is just a riprap. We had a big scour hole. 100-year-old bridge. We're just trying to extend the life of these things the best we can. A lot of bridge piling repairs. We got, I think, 7 bridges done. My pointer here. This piling here is completely hollowed out and has no structural value left. And all this rock ties, we have a deck issue too. We're losing a lot of rock through the deck. So we fixed all that. And the other end, this is a 2-span bridge. This one was really tight. It had 2 piles bad. And it only had a foot of pile showing, so it was hard for us to get up there and repaired a little, but we did get that done. I don't have pictures of the final on that, but I got pictures of a bunch of other ones here. This is a pier by Huxley on 310th. Two pier piling were completely hollowed out, useless. Our typical pile repair, we do the steel inside and CMP outside and pour concrete in them. That's a fairly lengthy bridge as well, so we're trying to extend the life because that's a $500,000 bridge at some point. It's by Cindy Hildebrand's house, you know where she lives, south of Highway 30 there. A couple pile repairs. It's a more significant bridge. You can see the big steel beams and the concrete deck and concrete cap. We have a lot of these. Why they put a wood substructure under those, I don't know. But we had one piling that was really bad, so we got that fixed. This was a bit of a unique one because we usually pour the concrete through the deck by punching holes through the wood. This had a concrete deck on it. So our crews used our hydraulic lift here to hold up a mechanism we made to shoot the concrete a long distance down to the pile repairs. So it was much more difficult, but they figured out a way to do it, so they're good at that. Speaking of ingenuity, this is something Andrew Nauman, our new superintendent, I challenged him. A lot of these, we have some beams that go bad, single beams, and to get to that one beam is very difficult. We oftentimes take the complete deck off, and that loosens everything up. So I challenged him to come up with a way where we can lift that deck off and just get one beam fixed. And he did a good job of coming up with something, but he requested we buy this new type of hoist or chain. It was $2,000 to $3,000, but he talked me into it, and I'm glad he did because the week after we did this repair, this popped up. This is the the dead end road back to the home 2 days before Christmas. We get a call from the landlord that says the bridge feels squishy. So we never like to hear that. The cap completely was rotted inside, so you couldn't really see it happening, and it had finally crushed. So we had to do something immediately. We closed the road, and that's the drive. There's a gravel road here, and this is the dead end back to the house.
This is 335th.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why this is a public road, I don't know, but it is. So it's our bridge. You can see it's already load posted, but we had to get in here very quickly. It's a little hard to see, but that triangle is the bridge. That's the house. There's the lane. He did have an access to get up through the field about a quarter mile and get out through here, but that's only useful in dry conditions, and it's not a very smooth ride to get out, but he had a 4x4 to get out if he absolutely needed to. But we told him we'd get on it as soon as we could. And the next day we got down there, dug out the back wall. That's the landowner back here. He helped us repair the bridge. He's a very nice guy. You can see it's just completely rotted inside that cap.
Do you know how old that bridge is?
I do not have the age on this one. I think it was in the 50s, 55, I believe. But because we had that hoist in, we could lift this up. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had the mechanism to do this in such a short-term basis. So we lifted it up, put new cap in underneath, and got that back opened in a day or two. So he was able to use it for Christmas. We did have another emergency repair in December. We don't pour a lot of concrete in December, but up on E18, just west of Highway 69, we had a concrete issue. This concrete slab here had settled underneath, but we had some big steel bars in here that was holding it up, so it was actually bouncing. It was a strange situation, so we had to do something with that right away, and we had a one warm day, so we were able to get that patched. We may have to do more with it in the summer upcoming here, but rock hauling. This is what we have planned for 2018. This will be the contract haul from Mark Marietta. We try to haul as much as we can, but we can't spend all the money with our own crews. There's only so much we can haul. So this is the part that will be contracted out. This will be far east side of the county. It's Highway 65. This part of the county, especially down here, has never seen limestone before. So it'll be a new experience for them. It makes a better road. We're running out of natural gravel locations, so that's why this is happening. But it's more costly to us because it's a long haul to get it here. But I think they'll be happy with what they see. Some people think it's more dusty, so I'm sure we'll get one or two complaints, but the majority are going to like this because those roads are really soft down there because there's no base. It's mostly sand.
Yeah.
So I think they'll like what they see. And these areas that you don't see lines on, those are what we're going to haul ourselves. We have that gravel pit right up here in Marshall County left. We don't have a big pile, but it should cover these two areas, and I think we're done with gravel on that side of the county until a new pit opens up somewhere.
You ever see a time we don't have contract hauling for us?
It's going to be, very difficult. We'd have to probably double the size of our fleet. We hauled about $300,000 worth in the fall, and we maxed it out pretty much. So we could do another two to three in the spring, and we have about a $900,000 to $1 million budget right now. So that leaves that extra we're going to have to contract out.
Well, I'd rather have a good road, so if we got to spend money to get there, we get there.
But we're definitely way more efficient than we were just 5 years ago.
Which is why we bought the tandem axle and the pups.
Correct.
Okay.
The motor grader accident up north of Roland. Just wanted to show you some pictures of that. This is right after the accident happened. The occupant was still in the vehicle at that point. We did just find out last week, finally, that he survived this. We weren't sure at the time because he was life-flighted out. This shows a picture. Our motor grader was sitting here. He had already maintained the intersection. You can see a windrow was here, so he had turned around and maintained the intersection. He saw the dust coming, so he stopped. He was completely stopped, and this car came down. You can see his wheel path right here. He was straddling the windrow and just ran right into the front of the motor grader. So we don't know why he didn't see it. There was no sun issue. He just ran into it. Like I say, lucky he survived. It tore the front wheel right off and got into the cab quite a ways. Damaged motor grader. The tire was ruined. The hub needed some work, and the front scarifier we had to replace. So it was minimum of $8,000 was the estimate. I think it might get a little higher than that, but the insurance companies are working the details out on that. And then about a month before, this was an odd deal. There's tandems in the back, and as we were maintaining the road, this back tandem just kind of fell off. We don't know what happened. So the reason I want to bring that up is we did have two motor graders down at the same time. We have two spares, so we had those in use. But as we go into this next cycle of motor grader lease, we talked about going down to just one spare. We used to have three. I still think it might be doable, but we need to talk to some dealers to make sure there'd be some rentals on a short-term basis to get them quickly. And if that's the case, we could maybe get down to one. But there's times when we get down to use both spares right now. We weren't planning on it because the machines we have are very reliable, but other things can happen.
Well, but it's going to be very interesting to see how we get through because we got 1 year left with these motor graders, right?
Yep.
It's going to be very interesting to see because clearly the first few years we had no maintenance issues at all with them. And they are still under warranty, which is a great thing, but the warranty, if we don't have equipment to back it up, the warranty, we're still down equipment. So I think it's going to be really interesting as you analyze here for the next year what's happening, and then we'll make a decision on whether we're going to have one or two spares as we move forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a real quick reminder on the snow and ice control policy. Our policy is 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. is when we're out with county crews. The part we do go above and beyond our policy at times is weekends. Our policy doesn't say we'll go out on weekends, but we do.
Mm-hmm.
The part we don't go beyond is that 7 p.m. during the week. If we're already out, we go past that sometimes, but we don't call crews out at 6 or 7 o'clock at night when an ice storm comes in. We got to wait till the next. They'll be out at 5 o'clock the next morning, and that's typical for counties. We just don't have an overnight crew. The shingles dumped in the ditch. We had this in at least four locations, so it was becoming a big problem for us. Not only did we have piles to clean up, a lot of nails go along with this, so we have to run our magnet across the road because they lose a lot of nails coming out of these piles. We did find a name on a box, so we got the sheriff involved. We clean up a lot of stuff out of our ditches, but if we can ever find names or anything, we go to the sheriff to help us investigate.
Where do those piles have?
Mostly on the east side of the county, or west side, but up north of Ames, and I think one was down south of Ames a few miles. So the sheriff thinks they have some leads, but they also wanted to put out to verify those leads to the public, so they have a Facebook page. They actually got the trailer stuck in one spot and left the trailer behind, so that created a little more evidence for us to go by.
Wow.
Moving on to construction. The only project we didn't have done the last time I reported was West 190th. We just had the guardrail left, but we've got that in now. It turned out real nice, and this mile stretch of road does get an overlay this upcoming year. So there's a lot of fill that went in there, so if there's any settlement when bumps created, we should be able to get those out within the next year. Grant Avenue, we did receive the Iowa Concrete Paving Association's award for the most outstanding PC award for 2017, so that's good news. That's something we've never gotten before, so I don't know the criteria, but I'll find out February 8th at their conference. Well, I'm sure we'll get a plaque or something for that.
You did not submit to them. They just, in their
no,
own,
this is
they
surprise.
Just found out and researched it and thought it was that good.
Correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
I haven't broke the news yet to Nancy Miller that her road might not be the best.
It's her story, let her tell it.
They both turned out really well, and that one reason for that, well, we know the benefits from I-35, but these are the first two paving jobs we use GPS controls for the paver. All four corners are controlled by satellites, and if it works well, it turns out a very nice product, but it's a little nerve-wracking counting on, you know, electronics to set your grade for you, but it worked out really well.
Good road.
Construction project design update. Final plans on University Avenue are into the DOT and finalized. We had a bit of a delay on the right-of-way from the Ames parcel just because we had to go through Ames and had to go through the Board of Regents. So getting all the meeting agendas, it took a long time to get done. But got that done, so we got all the right-of-way. That'd be paving University here down to 260th.
When does that occur? What's your expected schedule now that it's out?
Well, March 20 letting through the DOT, and then the benefit to that, we pushed it back to March, but we found out that was a good thing because the interstate work gets let in February, I believe. So we talked to contract, and they said, don't let yours go after that because the contractor knows they have that job. You'll get a better, cheaper job. So,
and concrete quality?
We
also
expect they'll bring in a portable batch plant and probably use the same mix from the interstate, so we expect to get the same benefits we did this year, so that's good too.
We are paving at the absolute right time,
yeah.
Because we are getting better quality roads than we're actually paying for.
Are some of our other lettings, February 20th, DOT letting as well, 113th Street Bridge, that's up here north of Zering, the yellow dot. Three more bridge replacements, have local lettings that are planned on February 28th for a board meeting, and that's this bridge up here, this one here, and then down on 280th down here, so those three. Working on plans for West 190th Street overlay, that's the one I just talked about, will be overlaid that box culvert we just put in. And then four bridge replacements for FY 19, we're starting design work on those right now. Sand Hill Trail Bridge, we were hoping to get that let here in March. We had some issues with one parcel with right-of-way, so we delayed that till April right now. We have a meeting tomorrow with that right-of-way negotiation. If that does not go well, I think we're to the point we're going to have to delay that project a year and to discuss our other options, how we acquire that right-of-way. That kind of brings up the topic of condemnation. I understand that kind of came up at the board meeting last week. I just wanted to give you a little clarification or information on how we buy right away. First, negotiations are confidential, so I'm not going to talk specifically about the one we have going on, but I can talk about the condemnation process. There are different ways we can buy right away, and they're both totally acceptable ways. One we call the informal process, and that's where we kind of just go out and negotiate with the landowner. We can only do that if it's under a $10,000 estimate, our initial estimate for that property. If it's over that, we have to follow the what we call the formal process. And the formal process is the process you can use if you have to use condemnation at the end. And you can only use condemnation if you follow that formal process. And that adds probably 4 to 6 months to the time frame. So I would point out with Sand Hill Trail Bridge that it was irrelevant because we didn't have the time to use the formal process. We got the final plans from the consultant in September. We had maybe a two-month window there to get the right-of-way bought, so we couldn't have used the formal process on that one anyway.
Aaron, can I ask, and just to repeat here, the informal process, so
does not result in going to condemnation ever? Or then do we have to flip
you
over?
You just have to start back over.
You have to start back over.
You can't get to condemnation from the informal. So if you're on the informal path, there's no legal way to get to condemnation.
Okay.
And to this point, what's happened, and Darren, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but we try to use the informal process wherever possible. So two criteria, well, one criteria, it's got to be less than $10,000.
Okay, yes. Thank you for that.
And the preference, I'll do my preference. My preference is to always avoid condemnation if at all possible. That doesn't mean it's possible 100% of the time. I mean, if you're going to have roads and bridges and things like that. But Darren and his staff has always done an outstanding job trying to work with landowners. We've had some hurdles, right? We had trouble on grant.
Biggest North Dakota about 3-4 years ago is when we really discussed this as a board, and that's where they got direction from the board, because we actually held a hearing and got landowners in here to talk about the entire project, and that's where the board kind of gave me the direction on how to, you know, proceed with right away, start with the informal process first, and it's worked well. I'd also comment, within this past year, we were also audited by the FHWA random audit. We get a lot of random audits in Story County because we're close to, they have an office in Ames as well as the DOT, and they say they like to come to Story County because they know there won't be any issues, and there wasn't. So but the process we use is good.
So you said that the previous board had selected that. So if we wanted to change, then we would have to have that discussion. As long as we are comfortable allowing Darren and his staff to move forward with always approaching an informal first, which is what you're doing now, right?
Yep, that's what I do now in general.
Then there doesn't need to be a formal.
So my question would be, and absolutely, this board has the authority to decide to use whatever process we want to use, but you can go, so the formal process is more costly and more time intensive.
Right.
You can always go from the informal process to the formal process if you need to. And so my question to this board would be, why wouldn't you start with the informal, try to come to some kind of agreeable resolution? Because remember, the informal process is the landowner agrees to sell the property for the amount that we're offering. Why wouldn't you start there?
Unless I know it's some issue on the road already that's going to be a problem and we know about it ahead of time, that's where judgment comes into it. Then I bring it to the board and say, hey, this is probably going to be an issue, so we should probably consider following.
This is a snap decision, but I would probably be comfortable saying I don't offer any expertise up or would be aware of any personalized experience that would supersede anything you have to do, and nor would I choose to. I think... How many of these, let's get to there. How many of these do you do on a yearly basis?
Oh, boy.
Just give me a number.
Each bridge is about 2 or 3, you know.
Okay, well, that's clearly 15, 2 or 20, 3 more 30. Than I'll do this year, and clearly more than...
Oh, you said 15 to 20.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't think that I would be comfortable in saying moving to the point that we would try to impose ourselves in. We don't have that kind of expertise. I don't know, what would you hope to go? I mean, tease this one out for me, and just if we're going to change, why would we change and put aside this kind of... experience.
I was more about that it had been set by a previous board, and I just hoped that we would be able to buy into the same thing, whether it's this conversation right here is good. I mean, there was unknown information. So.
But let's be clear about what was set by a previous board. It was a conversation around one specific road. It was a conversation about North Dakota. I don't know if you were here for any of that, Morris, but we had multiple landowners as we talked about. So we were putting a new bridge on North Dakota, and you've got that one, you got multiple bad curves, but you've got one really tough curve that there was a desire, I think a right desire, to try to get that curve softened just a little bit. But one of the landowners, and multiple landowners, weren't interested in building that road out, but the one landowner on the curve was absolutely adamant this is where it's going. And at that time, on that specific project, the board said condemnation is not something we're interested in on that road. I think also at that time, and Darren, you help me if I'm missing at that, the board also indicated that the board's desire would be to not use condemnation if at all possible.
Correct.
Which kind of laid it out. But as far as formal action saying to Darren Moon, you shall use this process or you shall do that, that's never happened.
And that's where I checked out. I appreciate it, and I'm very comfortable here. Darren gave me the information that I need to know that I now understand why this is happening, and should there ever be a need, I could ask that and put formally on the agenda. I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm glad we went through this process then. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, let me move on to 280th Street Skunk River Bridge closure. Just wanted to give you an update on where that stands. First of all, first and foremost, the landowners need a temporary access to get in there. It's a little hard to see on this picture, but the ones with names on them are the ones. I sent letters to all of them just kind of updating on the process, and it's going to take a little bit for us to come up with the how we're going to move forward on this, but county attorney is working with City of Ames on an agreement to use their private road, which is right here. So these, it's just farm ground, so they really don't have a lot of use to access at this time of year anyway, but we need to get that in place before spring especially. The city would like to see it in place soon, so I think Ethan sent them a draft agreement to get their comments at this point. I would comment that we'll get into this more in the budget and the programming, but we have some federal fiscal constraint rules on our bridge fund now that makes it a lot harder to borrow ahead or even schedule these bridge projects. At the same time, the funding swap's taking place. There's a lot of unknowns on how our funding's going to become available in the next year or two. So we'll get into that when we get into the budget and the programming here. If repairs are done, I've already commented to the board that I have concerns, even if we do repairs. Even before this happened, we were evaluating this bridge and a lot of others in the county, or if our motor grader can even go over it. And this one, we were going to stop going over with our motor grader, along with a handful of others in the county, because our motor grader weights are continuing to go up. So if we do just repairs on this one, we're not going to be able to get over it with our motor grader, so we're either going to have to come in from the backside and use the private road with a motor grader or bring a lighter truck down here to try to maintain that road. And then the same issue with ag. You know, we've seen ag equipment use it over the load posting. It's fairly obvious it's happening, so I have concerns about safety there. Third thing, the east abutment issues. When you ask me to estimate a lifespan on this bridge, to me, it's more than the bridge itself. It's this east abutment is so steep. And one of my prior superintendents happened to stop in our office a couple weeks ago, and he said 15 years ago, this abutment did wash out and had a huge scour hole behind it, and they filled it with concrete. Why I bring that up is because our repair option was to drive piling down, and if there's a big mass of concrete under there, that's not going to work. So we're going to have to come up with another repair option if we get to that point. But where I stand now, what I've told Ames is we're going to talk about the feasibility of a full replacement option when we get to our budget sessions this Friday. We'll start that discussion then, see what the impacts will have on the rest of our program. Start with that. If we determine it's not feasible, then we go back to the repair options and see if that's even possible. And then, you know, our last resort is come up with an agreement with Ames to use that as their private road as a future access. But
so they haven't expressed the desire to see the bridge repaired versus go to a private access to their water plant?
They want to see the bridge replaced completely. Their second option is they want to see it repaired to at least get vehicular traffic over it. So that's what they'd like to see. They don't want to see closure, period. And I did ask if they were willing to fund any of that, and I haven't heard anything back at this point. But if we hear that, if I hear back by our budget session, I'll let you know.
So I'm hearing that there's, Darren, I'm hearing that there's three options. I'm hearing that repair of this bridge is really not an option, right? So that takes us down to three, and I'm not suggesting that any of the three here are any good or preferable, but the three as I see it are replace this bridge with a new bridge at X number of dollars. Two, take the current private Ames Road and turn that into the public access route, which would mean the county would start, the county would assume ownership and start maintaining
correct.
That entire stretch. The third option that is a so much bigger conversation, but I think we're approaching the dollar levels that I think has got to be part of the conversation, and that is look at buying out everybody back there except for Ames. So there's 16, as I understand, 16 parcels, including what Ames has. I don't know how many landowners that is, but look at publicly purchasing all of those, turning them into some kind of conservation. I mean, it's right there on the Skunk River. Turning it into some kind of conservation ground that does not demand access. Then Ames maintains their private access because they're the only property owner back there. They utilize that and nobody else needs it. Again, I'm not suggesting it's a great option. I'm just saying it's an option, mm-hmm. and that's the only three options that I see, unless you guys have another.
How many acres is that? Since you
I don't know how many acres that is. I just counted it in 16 parcels.
We looked at that, and I can't remember off the top of my head what we came up with.
It's a lot of ground.
Seems like 2,000 sticks in my head for some reason.
A lot of ground.
How expensive is this bridge going to be?
Less than that.
$1 million minimum. $1 to $2 million is what I estimate.
At $2 million, you're not that far for ground
million,
along the
Skunk River. Millionaire. There are good choices here. Yeah. The thing is, you have a very low traffic. If the water treatment plant wasn't there, I think we have a completely different conversation.
So what we need to know, as I see it, and I don't think this first one falls to Darren Moon. I think it falls more to Mike Cox and the Conservation Board, if they have interest, is we need to do an assessment of is it feasible, and are there potential grant dollars that follow along with the purchase of this property? So feasible is, do the landowners want to sell?
Sure.
And are there some other dollars that follow along? I don't think that falls to Darren. Second one I don't think falls to Darren, and that is we need a legal assessment at if the county were to decide, and I'm hoping that we can come to some kind of great agreement with Ames and figure out how to put all this right, but let's say we don't, what kind of authority does the Board of Supervisors have to say, this access point is not going to exist anymore. We need another access point. You talk about condemnation.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden you're condemning what is a private road right now and turning it into a public road. I want to understand what that process looks like. And then as part of our budget process and looking at our five-year calendar, we need to look at what kind of cost estimate there is and what that does to the rest of the projects that we're looking at doing in the county. Don't forget, we've got 281 other bridges that we've got to worry about. And every time we make a decision like this, it impacts all of us.
The conversation with conservation, I want to make certain that we really, I mean, they've got projects, they've got already money plans for utilization of that money elsewhere. So taking on a piece of land like this, not only the purchase price, but then what are the future development aspects down the road of that?
So I would say zero future development prospects because you got no access. So the public could walk on, I would assume, but There's no way to get a vehicle up in there because it would be Ames private road. Anyway, like I said, Lawrence, it's not something that I'm suggesting. Oh, I've got the answer for this. I'm just saying we've got three options and none of them are real good.
Okay. Okay. Moving on to our shed construction. There's a sign of our rolling shed there. It shows all the entities that are involved in making this happen. Jensen's doing an excellent job. They're very safety ordinance. You can see that they fenced the entire properties for safety reasons. But it is on winter shutdown right now. They've got both beds completely built up to grade, so their next step is to put the building in on top of the concrete. So they're estimating March. They were putting blankets down to try to keep frost from going down, but that was before at the end of December, so I don't think they're going to win the frost battle right now. So it'll be March, April before they get into digging footings, I think. So it's on winter shutdown right now. And they expect to have both of them done in mid-June time frame.
Okay.
We did have a few change orders on there that were actually on the consent agenda today. I don't know if the board had any questions about them, but the biggest one was the change for the sidewalks in Roland. That's not something Roland had indicated up front that we needed to do, so it wasn't in our original plans, but in order to issue the permit, they required sidewalks, so that added additional cost there. And the other two were utility-related, which happens in projects like this. That's why you have contingency. You're not sure what's underground all the time.
So, Karen, since it wasn't in the original plan, when did Roland say, oh, by the way, you're going to have to redo that sidewalk?
Our consultant said they talked to him up front, but they don't actually get the actual building permit until it's let and they go through the process. So when they submitted the actual building permit, that's when Roland came back and said, well, we decided you need to put sidewalks in now. So unfortunate that it happens. West 190th and Grant, that's where we're studying this intersection here on if we need to do a four-way stop or not. And so our next step was to do a traffic count after people started getting used to the road. And so we did that a few weeks ago. And there is some warrants, the manual and uniform traffic control devices, what we use, and that's the legal document for traffic control devices. The warrants for a multi-way stop, first you have to have five or more reported crashes in the 12-month period. We've only had one there in the past 7-8 years, so we do not meet one requirement already, and the other is the volume requirement. At least 300 vehicles per hour for an 8-hour average day. So we did a traffic count there on the peak time, which is 7:15 a.m. to 8:15 a.m., and we came up to 494 total traffic entering that intersection. That was so the minimum requirements are 300 in the main and 200 on the minor route. So you need at least 500, and you have to average that for 8 hours in a 24-hour period.
And that's the heaviest hour right
there. We don't even meet it in 1 hour, so that's how far short we are. There's a provision to reduce that by 70% if the main exceeds 40 miles per hour, which we do. So we can drop that by 70%. That drops that 200 value down quite a bit, but we still only meet it for that 1 hour. We did count the next hour, and it dropped about a third of the traffic immediately. So we're not close to meeting the warrant for four ways, so that's why I'd be concerned, especially after what we tried putting it up, and because people don't expect it to be there for that
reason. What would we expect to come back and do this study again?
I want to first give this to the City of Ames because they're responsible for half of this intersection and one of the stop signs if we do put them up. So pass this on to them. Give this some time through the summer at least. We're getting through at least one school year. That's where most of this traffic's being generated from. So we can do it again next fall is what I was anticipating doing. And the other part of it is when Ames, you know, expands the bike path south, and then we're going to get bike path crossing there, so that's when we really need to decide what we're going to do. Right now, it doesn't meet the warrants.
Right. And clearly doesn't meet the warrants.
Yeah.
It's not even gray area.
DOT project updates. The flyover bridge is under construction, as you see, and this is anticipated to be done in the fall of 18, so still has some work to do. The other bridge, this is I-35. This is our 265th Street gravel road. That bridge was completed about a month ago. Picture of that. This span over here was strictly for that new culvert, four-cell culvert, to get water through the bridge is why they did it. So it would be a big new ditch that goes along through there. But 265th is back open. That was closed all summer, so it's good to have back open. 5-year construction program. Plan to have another work session this year like we did last year. Right now I'm targeting February 13th for that date. We did it last year after a board meeting in the afternoon. Two things I'd point out with 5-year. 220th Street or 13th Street, we did put an application to change the farm market route and move it down a mile, and that was approved. So this is now a farm to market route, so we can use farm market funds to pave that which is in our program.
So how far is the farm to market move on 210th? Does it stop there on 600?
This whole stretch is now locally classified.
No, I'm talking on 220th.
So it pretty much mirrors.
Oh, it just virtually drops down.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
And then the funding swap, and the major things out of that is 560th Avenue, which is down here south of Huxley. We have that in the program. We're not going to be able to use those funding swap funds, is what we're planning on doing. We have two projects down there north of 210 that we're going to fund 50-50 with Huxley, and then the 1 mile would be just ours. So those are going to be harder to fund now, so we'll talk about that.
Why is it not eligible?
They're federal aid monies, and before we could only spend them on federal aid routes, and that's pretty much our existing paved routes.
Right.
We did gain farm-to-market routes now. We can spend it on farm-to-market routes at a minimum, and that's a lot of our gravel roads too, but they did not lower it to the classification of local roads, so they're going to restrict that still.
And so remind us, we've got three major paving projects in our five-year calendar currently. We've got 560th, which is the one we're just talking about. You've got what I call 13th Street, which is 220th, which you just told us that's now farm to market, which frees up some money. And we've got 530th, which is University, which you're going to do a quarter mile of it yet this year, but then talking about the remaining mile and a half or 2 miles down to the Kelly Blackhawk. Those are the three that we have in our program. And if I recall, 560th is the first one on that list.
Correct. And I have been talking to the city. We had it in 19 originally. They said they can't get theirs ready until 20, so we're going to at least push it back 1 year.
But what point I'm making is the three of us, when you bring forward your five-year calendar, we are to reassess those three projects. Do they need to stay in? Do they need to be reorganized? Everything that we do, what I'm hearing today is all of a sudden 13th Street / 220th has become an easier project from a funding perspective to try to get done sooner rather than later.
Correct. Move on to Class C roads. Marty had asked me about looking into this a little more in detail to see what would need to be done if we wanted to go with some Level C roads. We currently have a Level B ordinance, and this is a map of the purple roads, our Level B sections. So we passed an ordinance, I don't know what that was, 15 years ago, and that ordinance has to specify maintenance levels in that ordinance. So that's been done. If we wanted to go to a Level C, that just takes it one more step. We need another ordinance specifying what those maintenance levels are and what type of gate you'd put on it. What a Level C does is make it more or less a private road, no trespassing with a gate. But yet it's still a public road, but only certain individuals are allowed to use it. That's the signs we have on our Level B roads right now. This is what we need for Level C roads. It's a lot larger sign, and it must spell out that it's no trespassing and then limited maintenance.
Are we required to do that limited maintenance then? Is it a public road?
You specify the maintenance level, but you have to post the signs.
Okay, but if we specify it, we have to perform it also, or is
whatever level you specify, we have to perform.
And is it uniform? So can you do different things on different Level C roads if you have the ordinance creating Level C? Or is it, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it for the entire Level C system?
That's how we did it for the Level Bs. It's consistent all the way through. I think since it's an ordinance, you probably have to be consistent on all of them.
The reason I brought this up is you're looking at what really is as we move. The designation from 210th to 220th was about a farm-to-market road. These truly are, in the truest of sense, farm-to-market roads. And what we're having, the problem you find, and you see they're up in the northeast part of the county, for the majority of them, that they are turning into entertainment sites, such that the farmers that would drive them just on using farm traffic, or how many times have you gone through the county and you're following a big piece of equipment that it both is an impediment and in some respects a danger to other traffic? They would like to use these roads as access points to and from. But what is happening, and you see this in a number of places, and Darren can tell you his stories, that these roads are being used by
young people or whoever and making them impassable when they go out there when it rains and there's any kind of standing water. What it turns into, the choice is you can't use it, don't want to go through that, because worst thing you want to do is stick a big heavy piece of farm equipment. That leaves you with the choice, well, I have to drive through a friend or neighbor or somebody else's field to get through this access point. So on a maintenance basis, they're not asking for gravel, they're not asking to be brought up. They're just saying, can we just make it a bit of a more of a hardship for people that are going to go out there and do a detriment to a county-maintained road as we presently have it.
And is the sign enough, or is it implicated?
Well, the conversation turns to the fact is, okay, if the sign goes up, is the sheriff's department going to enforce it? And then in turn, is the county attorney going to prosecute it? So it fails into something else.
And from what I've found, that you have to put a gate up, and whether you have to lock it or not is the conversation I had with Marty, because some counties have done the lock option. That becomes a hassle, because all emergency services have to have a key. But I've found you do not have to lock it. That's the part I wasn't clear on when we first talked about it. But you have to have the gate, but you don't have to lock it.
I think you see, and I would say because it's in my neighborhood, is that when the county put the shooting range in right across from me, that they had the swing gates, and they went to the lock. But you have multiple farmers, and we were one at one time, too, where that becomes an impediment because who's got the key? When I'm sitting out here on the road with the flashers going like, you didn't unlock this for me. And it turns the thing is, if you do it on a swing gate basis and you sit there and chain it like it were a livestock access, that doesn't deny access, but it really takes us to a different level with the fact that we're clearly designated to anybody with ill intent. Hey, you're not supposed to be here. And we're going to try to give it, a reasonable impediment.
Which B, we're not saying you're not supposed to be there. B, we're just saying proceed at your own risk.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden we'd be saying you're not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a long way to tell a short story, but these are the truest of farm to market roads in the county.
So I have real interest, Marty. In thank you for bringing this conversation up. I'd have real interest in learning more, but I agree completely that. Better have a conversation with the county attorney to make sure that there's an appetite, if we go down this road, to enforce when somebody gets on there and they're not supposed to be on there.
Certainly.
I'd like to know an example or two so I can go drive.
I would go up S-14.
Yeah.
Highway 2 or 210th Street.
Yeah. Right here is an important one, just straight north of Nevada.
Okay.
And that is just on your way up to the... Mr. Rowland, there I'm going.
And you can try south
590th.
Go turn off Highway 30 on 590th, right across the street from Better Equipment.
Sure.
That's a level B.
All right.
Right.
You'll get stuff.
Level C.
Yeah, you'll be out there for a while.
We don't have any level C's.
No, okay.
We're talking about taking our level B's to level C.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, correct.
Oh, okay.
And that's a map that shows you how many there are. Because people think, well, where are they? Well, they're mostly, predominantly, in the northeast quadrant of the county.
Okay. I'll go drive by those.
You should.
Physically look at them.
Don't get brave.
Yeah, don't
just because you have a little drive.
Oh, no.
We had a supervisor that, supervisor that shall not be named, who got stuck on a little
I heard this.
He's still trouble about it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Darren.
There's a picture of the sign. Found this, Googled it, and the next thing was a 5-minute video of kids going down a Little B Road destroying it. So you can find videos of it on YouTube if you'd like.
Yeah. Yes.
The funding swap, I won't go into as detailed as I was going to, but in general, right now what we know, the funding swap is going to be implemented October of 2018, this upcoming fall. And the big points are, we already touched on, we're not going to be able to use on anything lower than a farm to market classification. We do have to let all these projects through the DOT. The good points are a lot less federal oversight. 100% funded bridges, where right now our federal aid's 80-20, so we got a budget 20% local dollars. And the budget I submitted had one bridge that I might actually pull back because it had considerable local funding that went into that. That if we wait just a year, it'll be 100% funded.
Sure.
The downside is we're going to have to budget for these all up front because it's a reimbursement program. So it's going to inflate our local budget, unfortunately, but that's how they decided to do it. So I'll skip through those. I'll get in more detail when they're finalized. That brings me to drainage district issues. This is town of Fernald again, and this is where the railroad crossing is. We sent a permit in 9 months ago and finally got an answer on, and it was no, we cannot jet through here. That's what the farm fields look like for 9 months now. They exposed the tile to do the jetting, and we can't do it without the permit, and that's the problem. The trees in the right-of-way have grown into the tile, which is a common problem with the old tile has joints in it, and the railroad's perspective is that tile must be damaged if the roots are getting into it, and no, that's not the case. That's typical for roots to get into the joints of the district tile. So I did respond. I asked two questions. One, how do we get rid of the trees then, because that's still a problem, and two, can we jet from both directions, dig holes on both sides and jet in without going under the tracks itself? And I have not heard back yet on that, so that's my last ditch effort to try to get this taken care of. Their opinion is we have to bore a new tile under there, so that's...
I think we should put a culvert in.
I get it, but let's not.
Unfortunately, this one's at the up end of the district, so we have to put an open ditch a long ways to accomplish that.
Yes, but so the punchline for everybody is, by law, railroad pays for culverts. Drainage district pays for tiles.
Yeah.
And that's a recent change because of a lawsuit. The county sued the railroad to determine who's responsible for culverts and tiles. And the railroad won, you know, the tile side, but lost the culvert side. I think they're upset about that. So we're going to have to look at all the crossings we have now and make sure the trees are out of there, because any issue we have is going to be that much more difficult to fix.
I mean, would we have to ask to remove? Those are probably just mulberry trees. I mean, do we have to ask? It's in there right away. If we wanted to, as a county, go in and remove those trees or keep them out of there.
We volunteered to do it, but you do not work in the road right without permission. They will come out.
But that's what I'm saying. Did we ask permission to remove the trees?
I did, yeah.
Okay, we just haven't heard.
They haven't responded to that part of the problem.
Well, I mean, if we go, it's a very meager half step, but it's something.
Yeah. So I'll let you know what you hear on that response, but this is going to be more of an issue than just this one spot.
Yep. But I believe this goes back to maybe issues Jerry found in the village, the village of Fernald, as their hardships that they articulate when you talk to them, because they don't have very good drainage, and it's that story. There's probably a lot of it.
Still on DD-20, the Northern Natural Gas finally got their line moved, and they had to do a tile repair to get that done, but that is now done, so I think DD-20 is about wrapped up. DD-4, that's not this picture, but we did find that large rock under Lincoln Highway, 7-inch rock and an 8-inch tile, so there was pretty good obstruction there. So we got that out.
That's right on the Boone County line.
Yep. We feel like we solved that problem, but now we're dealing with the consultant change right now. That's a Boone County district, so they need to work with Kent to figure out who's going to continue on with that report.
And as I understand it, now Boone has moved ahead using Kent and Bolton Pink.
They did for certain projects, but they have not done for this particular one yet, so that's the next step in this process.
So, Jeremy, do you think that rock was a major problem backup there on the...
It had to be, and we weren't able to televise the entire tile down to the main, but we were able to jet it and didn't find any issues there. So we think it's open, so now it's going to be more of an issue of, is that 8-inch tile adequate? Then that would be an improvement.
And the tile, right? That's basically a bog right there, just as it stands.
Before we leave the Fernald issue, the discussion was on televising tile and the dollars involved, why you wouldn't want to do it. I mean, how many dollars were you talking there?
That one was $1,200, but they were only there for a short period of time. I think that was a 4-hour maximum.
Will there be any benefit? Because that was the ask that was made. Jerry can speak to that better than I, but was made of Jerry's team to have those dollars. You were there, you heard it.
Yeah.
And the follow-up was such that, can we come back in the spring and just find out if we've got any tree issues anywhere that, you know, we do what we can, where we can?
We can do that, but that's been a problem for a long time, and our approach has been we just go back and jet it every 2 to 3 years and spend the money on the jetting instead of televising, because we know we're going to find roots because the trees are still there.
Okay.
And they continue to grow in, so I'm not sure what the benefit of I don't think we're going to find any tile damage.
It was just a conversation.
Yeah.
It was an either or, and I just, you know, wanted to hear that we did address it and we brought it to ourselves. You spoke to it in a way that gives me confidence to say we're going to jet it and fix it that way.
Kind of that point where we either continue to do the jetting or we talk about doing a solid tile replacement, and that's going to be fairly expensive with the utility issues we have through there. And keep in mind that is a sub-district, so that bill is going to go just to the residents of Fernald, and it's going to be a pretty good bill.
Would it be too much to ask if you could get us a dollar value with that solid tile versus perf tile would be?
Yep, we plan on
going back. I mean, you were telling the story as I'm going to retell it, is the fact that as you are a sub-district, you will bear the expense to have this fixed in your map.
And the other issue is there, we're going to get some estimates on doing that, but then we have a, John Hunter wants another area drained. It's in the district now, but we'd have to do that probably with county funds. I'm not sure how, because it wouldn't be a district tile. So we'd have to spend county funds to tie a new tile in to drain the area he wants drained. So there's a couple issues going on there. I'll bring that to the board in the spring when we get some better estimates.
Thank you.
This is DD32. Rick, we had some discussions with some landowners last fall, and we wanted to wait till crops were out to do investigating. We did the investigating. You can see that we've dug a number of holes here, and the tile is extremely shallow. There's only a foot or two cover on there, and it's all broken at the quarter points. So we determined that we have about a 500 to 600 foot stretch that needs replacement. So I've reported that back to the landowner at least at this point, because there's a couple of options. We either put a plastic tile back in and limit what drives over it because it won't have enough cover. That means they put a waterway over it and not drive over it. If they don't want to go that route, we're going to have to put CMP concrete, more durable tile through there, and it's going to be more costly, and it's probably something we don't do with our own crews, so we're probably looking at doubling the expense there and probably getting into hearings. But so at this point, when I hear back from them, we'll have to bring it back to the trustees and get some input on how to proceed. This is real quick. District over far east is getting some trees. I've talked to Joe about that. But the pile is bigger than it looks in the picture, but they put a bunch of boulders over the district tile. That's a very large tile, and these boulders are small enough to fit in the district tile, so it's kind of a new issue. We're going to have to go out and get all those boulders out of there before they go into the tile and go downstream. We're going to have a real big problem. And then lastly,
just fieldstone?
Yeah. But it's a lot of it.
Why would they be dumping them there?
No, bank? You can see the intake right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I know. I see
there's
that.
There's already some I can see down
the bank
in the intake.
Or something?
Well, just downstream, this is a big gully that's been cut, so they're trying to stop that gully. While I'm on this, this gully's pretty deep. It's 5 foot and 10 foot wide. It's going to take a lot of dirt to be hauled in here. That's something we provide when we ditch clean. We're probably going to start billing some of these districts for at least some of the trucking to get it there. We typically don't charge for the dirt because that's free from our ditches, but they'll probably see a little bit more billings from filling in district work like this,
yep.
Just paying for our time of hauling it the extra distance.
Okay.
Good.
The beaver dam issue, I just want to bring that up. We're having a lot of beaver dam issues this year in particular, and it also came up on our message board for county engineers, a lot of discussions on that. There is I didn't realize a lot of counties have a beaver bounty. They still have them in place. They pay $50 to $100 per tail. I don't think we have that.
You just made Laura sad. You just ruined Laura's day.
That's right. Oh. Okay.
But if we don't take the beavers out, it comes right back. And the district one we had to do was $1,000 to remove. And then we've had a lot in our culverts this year, too. And then they come right back.
Uh-huh.
And
they used to sell dynamite in my grandfather's day. They'd go out there and fix it themselves. I've gone to several estate sales.
I hear this.
Oh, this harkens from the 60s, and we're going back to the time when that was permissible, that farmers used to go out and fix it that way.
We're going to talk to DNR and see what our options are. Right? You have to have a licensed trapper to come out and get them out, and we're going to try to get a list of who can do that, try to get on top of that. Lastly, new hires. We have Brad Tindall started as Equipment Operator 1. Our engineering tech position is still open. It's a very difficult position to fill. It's been open for a few months now, and I think we got a couple good applicants just last week, so we're going to start interviews next week finally. And our summer position is posted, so if you know of any farm kids, that's what we like, that know how to drive tractors, have them apply for this summer.
Super.
Thank you, Darren.
Thanks. Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Darren. All right, let's see. Lisa Markley got tired of waiting for us, so she's got her quarterly financial report. And what she would point out is that we're 50% of the way through the year. We've only spent 41% of our budgeted dollars, and we brought in 55% of our budgeted revenues. Everything's tracking pretty well. Any questions on the quarterly financial report?
That's what she said when I went and asked her.
Perfect. Public forum number two, opportunity for members of the public to comment on items not on today's agenda or anything. If you'd like to comment, please come on up. Seeing no one moving to the microphone, we're going to do a late liaison assignment, but we're 2 minutes late for our next meeting, so keep it as short as you can. Laura.
Okay. I think the only thing I'm going to bring up is that next Tuesday we have the full conference board for Ames at with the assessor, and that's at 6 o'clock. And the conference board did meet last Thursday. I think we're still involved with the animal control conversation, and here are the highlights from it. They have 8 staff, 3 interns. They want a 3% rate, cost of living raise with 1% merit raise, and they're only expecting a 5% increase in their health insurance. Their budget is up 6.3% of the $1.2 million that they are budgeting for this year. 343 are going to come out of the actual ending fund balance, if you will, the reserves. And so then the tax at for the citizens of Ames is going to be $873,000. And I will send all this to you.
So how did that $873 compare to last year?
It's up a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Pass. We got stuff.
All right. Okay. Nothing for me. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.